This episode of Access Utah was originally broadcast in March of 2025.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. A.J. Romrell is my guest today. He grew up Mormon and gay, and he has a new book out called Wolfact. Through linked personal essays, Wolfact charts a young man's transformation, weaving together wolfish fairy tales and mythology, Mormon theology and practice, piercings and tattoos, cave explorations, ghost stories, and more. Romrell explores a childhood of hiding, a familial reckoning, a religious exodus, and an effort to understand one's life is worth saving, even when the meaning of the word saving must be reimagined. A.J. Romrell is a writer, photographer, and educator. He's published work in Black Warrior Review, Brevity, Great River Review, and elsewhere. Originally from Sandy, he currently lives in Columbus, Ohio, with his partner and their feline companion, Sokka the Wilder Cat. Sokka, did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes.
Sokka. Wilder Cat, the Sokka sounds interesting.
Yeah, he actually came with it. I got him here in Logan, funnily enough.
Very, very good, yeah. Fun. So you, as we said in the introduction here, you grew up in Sandy. Came to USU, got your undergrad and master's at USU.
Yes, both.
Yeah. Now in Columbus, and I think you said getting your MFA.
Yep, the MFA in creative writing, creative nonfiction specific. But yeah.
So congratulations on the book. That's it's a great step forward in that. I think you hope to write. I guess the dream would be full-time writer.
Yeah, I think so. I have a lot of ideas, a lot of things I want to be writing. So hopefully this success kind of keeps going and I get to keep doing this thing that I love.
Yeah. So this is essentially memoir, right? It's linked essays, but it's a lot more creative than I made it sound just right there.
Yeah, it hits a weird kind of in-between space. A lot of it was originally written as separate essays that I then brought together and compiled and wrote more and connected and ended up becoming a bit more memoir-like. Sometimes people say memoir and essays or linked essays. You know, there are a lot of different kind of terms for it. I think the most well-known and well-understood is memoir, which is why we ran with that, is it tells that emotional story from kind of beginning to whatever you can call the end.
Yeah. So some reviews have talked about how you were a theater kid.
Yes.
This is kind of in three acts, right? And you, this sort of background interest in theater kind of influenced this. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up loving theater. My family had a DVD of Into the Woods, the original like Broadway production recording of it. And I just would watch that all the time and fell in love with it, wanted to be on stage and do singing and acting. And so when I went to high school, I joined a lot of those productions in the ways that I could and what didn't make it into all of them. But the musicals especially, yeah. I wanted to do. And so it influenced a lot because I wanted to do it and I was excited about it, but also the metaphors in theater of masking and costuming and also in a different way, putting yourself out there all felt really attached to this narrative I was putting together.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's have you read a little passage from the book. This is page 4.
Yeah. And,
hopefully that I'm reading a PDF. You've got the physical copy. Hopefully it matches up.
Yes, it does.
So you in this passage, you start with some mythology and then kind of apply that to experiences you were having.
Yeah. Okay. I once heard an old Norse tale about two wolves who race through the heavens. Skull, who chases the sun, and Hati, who chases the moon. Around and around the earth, they hunt these chariots of light, creating our days and nights. I learned that during Ragnarok, at the end of the world, they will succeed. They will swallow the sun and moon and finally stop chasing. I've heard these old Gaelic stories of Fraleik and the Wolf Month and Lodblad, when the starving wolf calls out, pleading for change. In the dead of winter, when nights lingered and stomachs growled, wolves crept outside a village and howled, a hungry cry, a deadly desire. Simple truths beneath a winter moon. From the depths of their bodies, an aching rumble roared from between their teeth. When I was young and alone, I acted out Grimm's Little Red Riding Hood in the backyard of my childhood home. I played each role, began as Little Red, a girl who meets a wolf in the forest. Beneath the tall branches of an apricot tree, I'd persuade myself to stray from the path, muddle beneath the summer sun, pick dandelions from the earth. Then I became the wolf, entered the backyard playhouse, gnashed my teeth, and swallowed the grandmother whole. I would take her place, waiting for myself to wander in with the dandelion bouquet, waiting to leap from the bed and swallow him whole too. Stomach ready to burst, I'd curl into my body on the floor of the playhouse, pretending to snore. Everything has a moral, and these tales could teach me how to survive. Once, when I asked my teacher why the hunter must slay the wolf at the end of the story, she told me he had to save the innocence inside his belly. When I asked how the hunter knew Little Red and her grandmother were alive enough to be saved, my teacher said he could hear them screaming from far behind the wolf's teeth. I've been searching for myself in stories for as long as I can remember. I want them to be about me. Starving and chasing and straying and becoming someone new. I once believed if I could find my place in the metaphor, in the universe and its stars and the galaxies above, it would mean I belonged in its marrow.
Hmm. That's Andrew Rumbrough reading from his book, Wolf Act. So a lot of these metaphors go throughout the book, right? In fact, the cover of the book is that Little Red Riding Hood's cape, right?
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant,
yes.
Red, and then a wolf belt.
Yes.
That duality, I guess, which I guess at least one of the interpretations there is you fighting with yourself over your identity.
Yeah. I think there were a lot of parts in that way I was trying to play growing up, you know, being Mormon, being gay, not wanting to be gay and pretending I wasn't even to myself. I had to pretend every day of my life. And so it felt like I was putting on these costumes and, you know, I was so afraid that if people knew who I was, I wouldn't be loved, that I would just change myself. Changed what movie I liked, changed what I would wear, just based on what I perceived other people wanted. I would do anything. I would change anything about myself to make myself loved. A lot of the book is trying to shed that and trying to figure out who I am outside of all that costuming. When I left the religion and when everything kind of fell apart and I had to rebuild.
Mm. Tell me about your mission. it was shorter than the allotted time,
right?
And I guess you came home from your mission and came out to your family. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I you know, a mission is supposed to be for 2 years, and I ended up only being out there for five months, I think it was, and I came home early because of, you know, mental health struggles that were all attached to me being gay. And what had been interesting is that I had the inklings of like being gay from a very young age, but I had fully just persuaded myself that I wasn't. I even thought I could be attracted to a man, but I could never love a man, so therefore I am not gay. And it wasn't until I went on the mission, and the mission is just so intense. You know, learning a language, I went to Switzerland and the language was really hard for me and being on my own was really hard for me. And I think a mission ends up just all the sort of mental health things you never processed all start to bubble to the surface and it becomes really intense. And I started thinking of hurting myself just in a way of trying to get a break so I could figure out why I was feeling so distraught. And why I felt like I wasn't good enough to be out there, all these things. And when I told my mission president this, he said that I should just dive into the work and keep pushing, and, you know, things get better when you do. And so I spent a week in the mission home reading scriptures on forever. I read the entire Book of Mormon. I highlighted every word that Christ said in it. And still those feelings didn't go away. But I realized that I knew that if I came out, he would send me home. And so I said it at that time. I told him that I was gay, or that I was having homosexual temptations. That's how I said it at the time. And he did end up sending me home, essentially. I still had the option of trying to stay out there, but I was like, I really just think I need to go home. And so I went home, even though I didn't really believe the words still. And it wasn't until a few months of being home, going to therapy, my therapist asking me why I hated myself, and me saying, I don't hate myself. And he was like, yeah, you do. And seeing a video called It Gets Better at BYU, which was part of the Trevor Project, that these queer BYU students were telling their stories of coming out and realizing that they were gay or trans or whatever, and realizing how similar that sounded to mine. And I just had a full-on breakdown when I realized, I think this is actually what's happening to me. And I think this thing that I admitted that I didn't think was true, I think it actually is true. Mm. And it just shattered every perception I'd had of myself.
Before we talk about your parents, I guess that must have been a big step, right, as well.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the book, I can't remember exactly where it is, where you're looking into a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. you're talking about the images there.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends with, this is me, right?
Yes, yeah.
It's they and then it's me.
Yeah, it's part of the dictionary piece, Dictionary of the Voiceless. And it felt very out of body, where the person that I was looking at in the mirror suddenly didn't feel like I was the same person. And there's a lot of mirror stuff, a lot of stuff happening in bathrooms in the book. A lot of life altering moments happen in bathrooms for me. And I think it's for two reasons. One, because you're alone so often. And two, because there are those mirrors and you're forced to kind of look at yourself a little bit. And I ended up saying "you're gay" into the mirror. Finally kind of speaking out that truth, that, and it shattered me, but it also felt relieving. And it felt like I had finally let that out of myself. I'd finally spoken into existence to myself these words. And it started the path to healing, even if at the moment it was so destructive to the life that had come before.
And this had to do, as you write in the book, to, you know, putting on costumes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Playing other roles.
Yes.
And then telling yourself that this is me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what point did you talk to your parents?
You know, it was pretty quick after that. I had a friend who was wanting me to join this multi-marketing thing, and I was really into it. I was going to do it. And then my brother... my oldest brother, Matthew, who is also gay and came out, you know, 10 years before me, which is a big part of the book as well. He had come to visit home, my parents' house at the time. And he told me not to do the multi-marketing scheme. And I got really mad and angry and I screamed at him and cried. And I ran up to my room and my mom walked in and she said, okay, this is not about the multi-marketing thing. What is this actually about? And this was happening maybe a week or two after that mirror moment. And I, for a long time, still was like, I can't say. I don't know. And she just sat there with me until I finally said, I'm gay. I think I actually said, I think I'm gay, you know, as we do. And she sat with me for a long time, hugged me. I cried a lot. She told me she loved me and always would. Really beautiful moments. And she asked if she could go get my dad and my brother and bring them in and tell them, which I did. And they both hugged me. And I remember my brother saying, "No wonder you felt so alone," because he understood how alone that feeling is, where you can't say it to anyone. Mm. And then you finally do.
Yeah.
But they were really, I mean, my family's been so wonderful through the whole thing.
Mm. Of course, not everybody gets that.
Right? No, I'm very fortunate.
Yeah. Yeah. What would you say to those folks that just have a feeling they're not going to get that reaction?
I mean, make sure you have support somewhere. If you don't feel like you can come out to your family first, come out to a friend that you think at least you really think is going to be okay with it, you know, and support you so you can have a person there for support. And two, sometimes it does go better than you think, you know, and you have to have patience and, you know, it's hard. You know, I'm very grateful that I got the experience that I did with my family. A lot of my struggles came from outside places, and it was really nice to have that with them. And, you know, I know a lot of my queer friends didn't get that experience and had to find that chosen family, because that can be just as strong and powerful as, you know, blood relation. And, you know, in the end, I think we need both. Mm. So, you know, just make sure you have support. If you feel like you're not going to get it at home, make sure you have it somewhere else before you kind of try to cross that bridge.
In fact, you dedicate the book for my parents.
Yes.
And for you, little lost boy who found your way through.
Yes.
So this the book, we don't want to ruin everything, but does have at least somewhat happy ending here.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I'm still here, so that's good.
Yeah. There you go. Let's take a break. When we come back, have more with Andrew Rumbrell, or A.J. Rumbrell. The book is Wolf Act, and that's out and available now. And he is in studio with me for the hour. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with A.J. Rumbrell. He's a writer, photographer, and educator. He's published work in Black Warrior Review, Brevity, Great River Review, and elsewhere. Originally from Sandy, Utah, currently lives in Columbus, Ohio, with his partner and their feline companion, Sokka the Wilder Cat. Maybe have a picture of Sokka. I'd love to see, see that picture at some point. So we're talking about his new book, Wolf Act. These are linked personal essays, a memoir, I guess we could call it, in essay form. Yeah. But quite creative. So we talked about you coming out to your family. And I guess maybe let's talk just a little bit about, you know, you grew up Mormon, right?
Yep.
Tried your best to fit there and found out you didn't.
Yes.
How did you navigate that after leaving your mission, coming out to your parents? You were at BYU, I guess, when you saw these videos, et cetera. And
yeah, I mean, I was living in Sandy, which is, you know, kind of right outside of the BYU area. And I was going to Utah Valley University, which is, you know, right next to it in Orem. And, you know, I ended up, that group that I had seen the video from that went to BYU, it's called the USGA, the group Understanding. You know, they have a new name now, which is better, but the old name was Understanding Same Gender Attraction. And it was kind of BYU's version of a gay straight alliance at the time. And so I ended up going to that group after coming out and found a really big support group there. That was really wonderful. And it helped ease the process because I was with all these people kind of going through the same thing of trying to figure out, can I be Mormon and queer? So it was full of people who were trying that path, people who had left, people who were still very devout, had a whole range. And we got to have these discussions about how we were handling it. It was a really, really beautiful time. And I would say I still was trying to be a part of the Mormon religion until, because that all happened in 2012. And 2015, when the policy change regarding queer people and the children of gay marriages came out, that I was finally kind of the moment I was like, I just don't think I can do this anymore. And that was what I would call my official leaving of it. It was dwindling, you know. The more I thought about what I was a part of, the more it just didn't feel right to me anymore. And then it was a difficult process, but I was very grateful to have that time to move out of it, where it wasn't I guess I'm gone now and I have to find something to fill this hole.
Yeah.
I got to kind of fill that as I went.
Yeah. I believe around that time you wrote a piece expressing anger at God, right? I guess not only the church, but God. I wonder what you've come to now in terms of faith or belief or...
Yeah, it's been an interesting process, something I'm still trying to figure out exactly what I believe to this day. I'm not a part of any religion specifically. I do have spirituality, and I'd say I believe in a lot of energy type of things now. Something that might go a little bit more towards kind of chakras, sometimes a little bit more into paganism, just kind of depending. But what I like to believe is that we all are connected by invisible strings, essentially, this energy of the universe that connects us. That's what I really believe in, is connection to each other, to ourselves, possibly to a higher self out there. It took a long time to become okay with not knowing, because I think Mormonism pushes so much of the I know this is true, that to become comfortable with not knowing was a process. I did go through a lot of anger towards God and the religion for a while that I had to move through before I could come to the place where I am now, where I'm grateful for the childhood I had, because it's led me to a really beautiful place now. But it was wasn't an easy place to get to.
Right. The church made some changes to that 2015 policy later.
Yes.
I don't know if that helped you with I'm sure you'd like to see more, but what do you feel about that, those changes?
I mean, I'm grateful that they made those changes. I wish that there had been more of an apology stated about it. But I am grateful that they realized how much they'd hurt people with this. And so it's not something that brought me back, because I think I just moved out of that belief system. And I think it just did too much damage to really reconcile that sort of space ever again. But I think that there is a new wave of kind of people coming through the religion that are doing real good and trying to make it a more open and welcoming space for queer people. And I hope that continues. You know, I hope that building still happens. There are still so many groups like Mormons Building Bridges and Mama Dragons and all these places here in Utah that are so wonderful and trying so hard. And that is great to see.
I wonder if we could have you read another couple of passages. This is from you. You mentioned the dictionary chapter. So tell me, first of all, what you did in this chapter, this essay.
Yeah. So this chapter essay, it's what we call in, you know, creative nonfiction terms, as a hermit crab essay that's taking the form of a more official form. and then inserting, you know, personal narrative into it. So it can look like a doctor's form or, in this case, a dictionary definition. So it's a bunch of dictionary definitions A to Z for poetic writing terms. And it starts off very cold and distant from me. I talk about myself in third person. And then it has that moment that we talked about earlier where I'm looking into a mirror and say you're gay to myself. And the third person, he turns into the first person I throughout the rest of it. And the form starts breaking down as we go through. And that was all to showcase how I had been trying to find ways to define myself through outside means, whether that was the religion or whatever else, other people. And I'd been letting those things define me, and I was trying to learn how to define myself and how to break free from those things, trying to release myself from those definitions.
So this is an entry called Negative Capability. Have you read this?
Yeah. One, a theory first articulated by John Keats about artists' access to truth without pressure and framework of logic or science, capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, or doubts without any irritable reaching after fact or reason. A. When my first boyfriend broke up with me in 2012, he said it was because he just didn't love me anymore. I remember afterward driving through a Utah canyon to my parents' house. I called my sister. She told me it would be okay. She told me I would make it through this. She told me it didn't matter why he didn't love me anymore, because I was good regardless. But I wanted a reason. I demanded one. I couldn't stand the mysteries attacking my mind through the mountainside. I couldn't live in negative capability. I screamed in the car, howled against the wind flowing in through my open windows, punched the steering wheel, kicked the door. An answer may have whispered from the mountainside beside me as I drove. Maybe it fell from the dusty night. I couldn't hear anything existing out in the void of space. I wouldn't even hear myself.
Hmm. I wonder if you could read Sublime and Volta, those two entries.
Absolutely. Sublime. One, a term identified by the poet Edmund Burke in 1757 as an experience of the infinite, something terrifying and thrilling because it threatens to overpower the perceived importance of human creation in the universe. Two, many writers throughout history have believed that to experience something like the sublime, one must traverse through the wild, mysterious expanses of the natural world. Three, I wanted this to be true, that when God slipped away and I listened to the universe instead, I could find the answers. That maybe, if I disappeared into the wild like them, I'd discover truth. I'd find a voice there in the confines of the earth. Volta. One, Italian for turn. Two, in a sonnet, the volta is the turn of thought or argument. Three, I walked out of Timpanogos cave, back into the light and air of the mountainside, the experience of darkness and nature drifting away from me. Pulling a tattered notebook from my bag, I sat on the bench by the cliffside and wrote every feeling, every memory, every breath. And so unlike the years before when I walked into the woods screaming for God, and even unlike a search for an outside voice, I listened to the universe, the sublime, the natural, and I transcended them all.
Mm. That's Andrew Rumbrow reading from his book, Wolf Act. So a couple things there. First, I want to talk about, you know, you mentioned your tattered notebook.
But, yes.
Has writing always been a part of your life? When did that become? Do you always have a notebook with you?
Yeah, I do these days. Mm-hmm. Growing up, I knew I wanted to be a writer from about 11. And at that time, I only wanted to write fantasy novels. That was my big obsession. Like after I read Harry Potter and Aragorn, I realized like, oh, maybe this is something I could do. And so I got really into it then. And then when I came here to USU, I had to take different genres of classes for creative writing. And I was kind of forced to take an intro to nonfiction class. And I realized, oh, I think I actually am interested in this. And so I started taking more. And I ended up taking a bunch of classes with the professor here, Jennifer Seiner, who at one point asked very early on in one of those classes, write down the top 10 things you're most afraid to write about and then write about them. Hmm. And, you know, I started kind of pouring out that sort of emotion and drama and realizing that I was processing through it and also finding answers. And realized I think I want to tell this story to people who might need to hear it because it was stories that saved me. Mm. And hearing other people's stories saved me. And it was also Jennifer Seiner who taught me to take a notebook literally everywhere I go. Mm. And write in it every day. At least try to, even if it's, I don't want to write today, written 10 times. Mm-hmm. You know, that if you show up every day, then it's going to keep flowing. So it's always been a part of what I've wanted to do. And this is just kind of finally the fruition of that dream coming true.
Yeah. Often asked writers what writing does for them. You said it saved you.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, the writing your stories, yeah. What do you read?
Oh, man. Let's see. I mean, right now I'm reading... Wow. I am about to start. You're catching me in that moment of ADHD where I
right.
cannot remember titles.
Yeah. By the way, people often ask me, hey, what was your interview this morning?
Yes.
And I, you know, my wife will ask me, I said, I'm sure I had one, right? So.
Right. It's there somewhere.
So don't take offense, AG, if I tell my wife, it was good. I remember it was good.
I remember.
So no. I have to look it up to remember it was A.J. Rumbrow. But
I mean, I tend to read more of the, you know, fantasy and sci-fi stuff in my daily life. For my degree, I've been reading a lot of different memoirs. You know, I tend to reread a book called Tiny Beautiful Things by Cheryl Strayed. I define it as the thing that the Bible that replaced my Bible because I grew up, you know, learning that when you question things, you don't have answers, turn to the Bible and turn to a random page. And I kind of actually use that practice. It's a book of collected advice columns from Cheryl Strayed. And, you know, it's just helped me at a lot of different times in my life, really inspirational stuff. So that's when I reread a lot. It's called Hail Something is the sci-fi book I'm about to pick up and read that my family's been currently obsessed with and has been telling me to read for so long. I don't think it's called Hail Mary, is it?
I'm not familiar
with
it.
Thing.
No, yeah. Yeah.
It is.
Oh, it is.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah. Hail Mary
by Andy Weir. You're going to be picking that one up. Okay.
That's the next one.
Recommendation from your family. All right. That's
yes.
great. Another thing here before we go to another break. You in those passages that you just read, you talk about the natural world.
Yeah.
Right? Tippecanoe Cave. What does that do for you?
You know, I think the more I kind of turned away from religious practice, the more I turned toward almost the idea of worshiping nature, but just being more in tune with it, I think it matched the being more in tune with myself, the more connected I felt with nature. And I always just felt more peace when I was out in it. I think it's a benefit of being here in Utah and growing up here, you know, having the mountains next door, being able to walk 10 minutes away and be on a hiking trail here in Logan. It was just the place where things quieted and I didn't have all those other voices and whatnot telling me what to think or what to do. I didn't have to show, I didn't have to costume, I didn't have to do anything. And so even though I've moved past a lot of those things, I still find it to be a place of peace and inspiration that I go to, and I love to write about it in those ways as well. I'm getting really into writing about space lately. Mm-hmm. It's a big thing that I...
Outer space?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Space mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think writers forever have been, you know, writing about the beauty of nature, and I see why. It's just, it's a wonderful thing to put into your work. It's inspiring, and it's always got that little bit of chaos that it's never going to quite be the same each time.
Well, let's take another break. We're talking with A.J. Romrell. His book, Wolf Act, is out and available now, and we'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with A.J. Romrell. He grew up in Utah, got his bachelor's and master's degrees at Utah State University. Now he's at Ohio State University getting his Master of Fine Art. And his new book is called Wolf Act. It's out and available now. So, A.J. Romrell, I wanted to talk a bit about there's a passage in, and you were telling me off air here that I couldn't remember where it was, but it's apparently you take a trip to Disney World.
Yeah, right? I lived there.
You lived there.
Yeah, I worked there.
You worked there. tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was actually when I finished off my undergraduate degree here. I had a bunch of electives left over. That's all I had to do. So I took an internship at Disney World, just their like Disney College program, and finished off my credits that way. And so it was when I was married to my ex-husband, and we both loved Disney everything. And so we ran off, and I was there for about a year and a half, a little bit more. And yeah, I mean, it was a wild thing to go to another place that was all about costuming and covering yourself up and pretending, even if it was like a little bit different version of it. It was also very weird to be in the most magical place on earth, and this place of fairy tales and magic, and also have my marriage crumble apart while I was there. You know, I felt so alone when I didn't have everybody else with me. You know, I think our worst traits, both my ex-husband and I, just kind of came out in Florida. And so we ended up separating partway through, and I was suddenly living on my own for really the first time ever. I had gone from kind of a very controlling religion to a rather controlling marriage. And, you know, I'd shaped myself to everybody else out of that fear of people leaving me if I said the wrong thing or didn't like the same things they did. And suddenly there just weren't those expectations on me. And I realized I had no idea what I liked and disliked. I didn't know what movies I liked, because I would go to a movie and adjust my opinion to whoever I was with. I didn't know what clothes I liked to wear because, you know, for so long that was dictated for me. And then I, you know, through Mormonism, you know, and then I just had never explored it. I hadn't explored anything. I remember a therapist telling me it was kind of like being in middle school, where middle schoolers get to put on all these different kind of versions of themselves. They explore kind of punk and emo and all these different types. And I never really did that because I was so afraid. I never tried to make those choices. And so there I was at 28, not knowing if I liked to wear scarves or not. And it was a wild thing to go through. And I had to get a friend to go to the store with me and pick out clothes for me because I didn't know how to do that for myself.
So how did you navigate that? You just tried on a bunch of different clothes until you found the one you liked or whatever it is?
Yeah, I mean, it was great to have, it was a therapist who told me I needed to take a friend with me because then she would pick things that I wouldn't normally pick for myself. If I had anything, I would pick for myself. So I would just try on things, and I would sit there and I would stare in the mirror. Again, mirror is just always a part of my life. I'd stare in the mirror, and I had to take that moment, and it was a long time in that store, her and I, her running to grab different clothes, for me to really determine, like, okay, I think this is me saying that I like this and not some preconceived notion of what, whether this is too gay or too whatever. You know, that's why I didn't wear scarves, because I was like somehow associated men wearing scarves as men being gay. And so I was like, I can't do that. I have to steer way far away from that. And then I realized I did like wearing scarves. I liked it as an accessory. It was fun to do. And it was a lot of trial and error, you know, a lot of wearing something for a little bit and hating it after a week and kind of having to stuff it away, you know. Just took time and it took support.
Yeah. So there's a through line here, right? These metaphors, right? You're you're both the wolf and your Little Red Riding Hood. You're playing all the parts, right?
Mm-hmm.
From you as a little theater kid, all the way through, I guess, pleasing people, right? Putting on those costumes and hiding yourself. There's got to be, and you referred to it, it's got to be kind of a frightening part of this. This is just me. It's now me presenting myself.
Yeah. It's a risk, I think, you know, you have to take, where I had to realize that I would rather be myself and be who I am than be stuck in a marriage or a relationship or with a friend, you know, who didn't accept me or didn't want the best things for me, and that I would rather be alone than cover myself up again and pretend to be somebody else. And it took a long time and a lot of pain to really come to that understanding. But I remember coming to it, and it was the moment I finally decided on divorce with my ex-husband, when I realized, like, we're just not the best match for each other. And I would rather be alone forever than put myself in a place where I couldn't be myself, my full self again, because I just didn't think I could with him based on our past. And it was 3 days later that I met my current partner on an app, but you know, and it's still like, you know, it took time, but it was like I'd finally opened myself up enough that the universe was like, okay, you're ready now.
Yeah. So that dedication, you dedicate this to your parents, and for you, little lost boy, you found your way through. You feel like you have found your way through.
Yeah. I think I found a way through to myself, really, to being able to live openly and fully as who I am and not as who I think I'm supposed to be or think other people think I'm supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, the book is out and available now. Wolf Act, congratulations on that. What's next?
Well, I am working on another collection, another sort of linked essay thing. This one, in a lot of ways, picks up around where Wolf Act leaves off, because Wolf Act ends around the time that I got my HIV diagnosis and decided that I wasn't going to hide that away. And the next book is a lot more outward, a lot less kind of like these like inward struggles, though it still has plenty of that. But it's a lot of how do I live in this world now? And I am having a lot more fun with it and trying to let myself have more fun. Writing about video games and apocalypse narratives and places in the world that aren't suited for life, but life finds a way anyway. Really exploring what it means to just live in the world now that I have found a way to live in my body. How do I live in the world? You know, and then I'm also working on some queer fantasy novels that I've been working on since I was a kid, really, that I'm hoping to get back to soon, and even some poetry that I love to work on.
Yeah. I guess in the meantime, you write every day, right? I guess.
Yes,
you
I do.
Have that notebook with you at all times.
I do.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking to me. A.G. Rumrell has his new book out. It's called Wolf Act. It's out and available. And He's returned to Logan, USU, where you you got your first 2 degrees. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.
On Tippie College of Business at the University of Iowa Week, do you know a coworker with a side hustle? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the American Association of Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jennifer Nargang, professor and Henry B. Tippie Excellence Chair of Management and Entrepreneurship, discusses how it might affect them at work.
When someone starts a side hustle, it might change how they do their day job, but not always in a good way. My research has found that when people have a successful side gig, their behavior at their full-time job often becomes less than friendly to coworkers and managers. You could almost say they become jerks. We surveyed 200 employees who also have side hustles. We included their colleagues at their day job, too, to see what impact the second job has on the first. We found that they begin to show more hostility to their coworkers by feeling angry, irritated, and annoyed with them. Not only does this alienate them from their coworkers and create a more difficult workplace, we found it also reduces their productivity. Our research found this behavior is caused by a loss of control. Side hustlers are so used to the autonomy they have in their second job that the relative rigidity and lack of control in their full-time job starts to wear on them. They have so much freedom in their side gigs that they begin to feel boxed in by their full-time job. That frustration takes the form of lashing out and other counterproductive behaviors. But we also found an upside to side gigs in that they can improve performance in the employee's day job. Rather than getting angry, employees can opt to deal with their frustrations by increasing initiative in their full-time jobs and restore control over their work. This not only keeps their frustrations in check, it also benefits their work performance. What solutions do managers have when their side-gigging employees are not playing nice with coworkers? We found counterproductive behavior can be mitigated if managers provide more autonomy to their side-hustling employees so they feel less boxed in.
That was Jennifer Nargang of the University of Iowa. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from AAC and you, advancing liberal learning and research for the public good.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. People in cities can often walk, bike, or take public transit, but sometimes they need a car, for example, to pick up a large purchase or to get to an appointment across town. When that happens, residents of Minneapolis and St. Paul can turn to EVE, an electric car share program.
We're not replacing transit, we're not replacing bike or pedestrian transportation. We're trying to solve the problem of when folks need to do something that does in fact require a car, how can we meet those needs without folks feeling like they need to purchase a vehicle?
Aaron Kaiser of the City of St. Paul says the program is a partnership between the two cities, the local utility, and Our Car, a nonprofit car share service. The cars are available for one-way trips, so users can find and book a car with the EV app, drive it, and then drop it off almost anywhere in the program's 35-square-mile service area. EV cars can be charged at no additional cost at city-owned chargers that use renewable energy.
Folks who are used to transit, pedestrian, bike transportation, this is just one more way that they can continue to live a car-free or a car-light life.
Which is good for the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.